For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to meet, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle. Guys, it's getting closer. The election is just around the corner. We had the final debate is over. And now everyone has to go through their individual debates. Now, this has been a really interesting political year in the fact that some things that several years ago would have been completely off the table are now being discussed and, you know, being embraced. For example, 4 or 5 years ago, if I had called someone a socialist on a political scale like what we've seen now, it would have been considered an insult. He can't be a socialist. Socialists are bad. Well, now we see a movement, including a candidate who not only admits to, well, I shouldn't say admits to, but is proud to be a socialist and wants to, you know, work toward converting the American system to a socialist system. How did we get here?
Well, not only how did we get here, but what does that mean? I mean, when you've got a presidential candidate of the United States that comes up and, you know, declares that he's a socialist, what exactly does he mean by that? Is he trying to channel Lenin here in the United States, or you know, or does he mean something very different? I mean, I think he's explained that he is a Swedish brand of socialist, and once again you kind of scratch your head of, okay, well, Sweden's a peaceful country, so that means, yeah, maybe that's a nod towards the foreign policy, but the socialism's still the same. I mean, there's a lot of different things that could be implied by socialism.
Well, and the term socialism, we know, as from a Catholic intellectual and teaching tradition, you know, the past 100 years we've had various holy fathers, various popes write encyclicals and other formal writings warning us against socialism and decrying it as a great evil and great error to be avoided at all costs. But we also know that terms shift and change over time, and you know, the socialism that, say, you know, the church was confronting 100 years ago may not be, and I think we're all going to, not quite maybe the same flavor of socialism that, say, a Bernie Sanders might be promoting in others.
The Holy Father came out with Laudato Si, and he continued that tradition of Holy Fathers, I think, rejecting the concept of socialism, but he did kind of make a nod towards the idea that, you know, the term of socialism has changed a little bit, and this idea that socialism may automatically carte blanche be against what the church teaches, it may be a little bit more fuzzy, I think, in Laudato Si than it had been previously.
Well, certainly I would say, you know, if we go back to St. John Paul the Great and his writing Centesimus Annus on the 100-year anniversary of Pope Leo the Great's encyclical Rerum Novarum, I tend to go with St. John Paul the Great all the time anyway. But here, I think he's particularly helpful because not only because of his intellect, but and grounded in virtue, but also he had firsthand encounters with both National Socialism and communism, a socialist Poland, from which he could see up close and personal what the really vile nature of socialism can mean, and the havoc it can wreak on society, the human person, family, things like that.
Right, and so when you look at those, but I think when you look at the sort of negative side of socialism, you know, the atheist state, the total materialism, you know, the whole kind of neglect of any sort of I think, cultural or spiritual side of humanity. You know, when you have a Bernie Sanders or somebody like that stand up and say, I'm a socialist, is that really what Bernie's meaning? Because
he may intend some of that to freight in with it, but clearly you're right. You put your finger on the problem. On one hand, socialism, we've got a long lots of evidence and long track record of the terrible ills that socialism brings, yet it's popular. What's the glamour, what's the allure to a rally cry around socialism that has so many people going, I think socialism's a great idea, especially among the young. And so it can't just be, because people, if it's just pure evil, then yeah, everyone would just simply reject it out of hand. No, that what we find with a lot of, I would say, it's almost like an economic heresy. With heresy, there's always truth mixed in, right? Because that's what's going to, there's something appealing to it, or we wouldn't be tempted to sin, right? There's something appealing. There's something we want to get out of it. There's something that attracts us to it. And so that is true with the current contemporary American flirtation with quote-unquote socialism. I think it's offering some solutions. It's offering some benefits that are attracting people to it in a way that maybe masks or hides some of these other ills from every other time it's been tried that we're just kind of ignoring. But so what do you think some of those things might be? How might we get at it?
Well, I can understand some of the attractiveness to it to a certain extent. I mean, when you look around our society, you look around our culture, you see a growing problem with debt. You see a growing problem with people who are for whatever reason, and I would say, you know, to a good extent, I think this shows a lack of virtue in the American character to a certain extent. But for whatever reason, there are people that feel like they're being left behind
and shut out unfairly.
And I think that the another side to what makes it what makes socialism in its current form attraction is exactly that sense of fairness. And I think we've let corruption creep into our culture enough that people look and they think the system's rigged. You know, they look at it and they say, well, you know, the outcomes aren't what I would want, so therefore something must be against me pushing me down. The system's rigged. And so they want to kind of unrig the system. And I think whether these things are true or false, those are the types of things that I think are the siren call to a certain extent that are leading people to want to glom onto something like socialism.
Yeah, there's something about I could see an appeal to socialism packaged a certain way might appear like it's more like we're all in it together because we're all going to socialism promises to sort of erase boundaries between, you know, different conglomerations of different companies and things like that, because we're all just the government's going to own it, and the government's the people. So the people now own the means of production, and so therefore we're less likely to be shut out as a result of it. It's a way of remedying what they may see as an injustice. There's also lots of promises, since we're all in, if we have sort of a homogeneous, the whole economy is sort of engulfed by the state, well, then you can begin to make, you know, sort of unilateral policy decisions. Like I heard last night, one of the was, you know, if you make $125,000 or less, then college would be free for you. And so you can make promises like that only if you control all the universities.
Exactly, right. Yeah, for that promise to be able to be
you got to have power taxation, too.
You've got to control the university. You know, and I think you're right, though. When you go back, you know, these things they're a veneer, I think. I think when you start to scratch the surface a little bit, I think what you start to see is that same old socialism that is doing away with the concept of private property. It's doing away with the concept that humanity and human flourishing is more than just material flourishing. It's more than just making sure that everybody has enough food and a house and clothing. Human flourishing involves a culture, and it involves family. It involves a lot of these types of things.
A certain kind of anthropology, right?
And I think you're right. I think once you get past that veneer, when people identify themselves as socialists, they're kind of preaching that same old-fashioned socialism that the church has stood against for 130, 140 years now?
Right.
Yep.
Funny how the church has stood against it since its inception.
Right.
Of socialism, that is. Yeah.
And that leads us into our guest for today, Tim. We're going to bring...
we can't tackle this alone, Mark.
Exactly. We're going to bring in Dr. David Deevil, and he wrote an article recently that caught your interest. You shared it with me. The 7 Deadly Sins of Socialism. So
woo-hoo!
We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we get right back, we'll have Dr. David Deevil here to discuss a little bit deeper the implications of socialism.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just 2 words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Anytime you get in the car, turn on the radio, you know that there's going to be something encouraging.
It's such an encouragement and enriching to my own Christian walk.
It brings me a great deal of peace.
I really am blessed whenever I listen.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. This is Timothy O'Donnell, still with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford, and we would like to welcome to the program Dr. David Deevil. How are you, doctor?
Fine. Although I have to say, I do pronounce it Deevil, like evil. So I hope that doesn't warn you off.
I love that. Yes, Dr. Yeah. Deevil. Well, welcome to the show.
I'm the Deevil you know.
Well, you're a professor of theology at the University of St. Thomas up there in beautiful Minnesota, and we are delighted to have you on the show because we are going to talk about a lot of different things, but I think our main theme is really going to talk about socialism as it relates to a recent article that you had published.
Yes.
So tell us, I'd like to begin with a little bit of information about you. Would you tell us a little bit about so you're a professional theologian at a Catholic university. So, you know, how did that come about? How did you sort of discern that vocation?
Yeah, well, I was a Protestant growing up, and I went to Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I was a Calvinist, and I discovered during my time in college and shortly after the beauty of the Catholic faith and the truth. And so I became a Catholic about a year after I graduated from college. And in looking around, I determined that probably what I was best at, I worked at an insurance company, and then I did some other odd jobs, but I thought what I was best at was teaching and writing and speaking, and so I decided that I should go to graduate school. And when I decided what the big questions were for me, I decided that they were largely theological, but they had to do with philosophy, literature, economics, and history. So I went to Fordham University and studied theology there with a number of great thinkers, including Avery Dulles, who was the first American cardinal, made a cardinal just because of his theological contributions. And I finished a PhD in historical theology on Blessed John Henry Newman on the question of divine judgment. And I ended up at St. Thomas here because my wife, who is a professional philosopher, got a job here at the University of St. Thomas. And so I then hooked on teaching courses at the St. Paul Seminary, the theology department here, and then now I have a position as a visiting professor of Catholic Studies, and I'm the editor of Logos, which is an interdisciplinary Catholic quarterly. So I've been teaching courses on theology and broadly Catholic thought and culture for now probably the last 12 or 13 years, and I'm enjoying it more and more each year.
Now, Dr. Deville, you're also connected a little bit with one of our favorite institutes here, the Acton Institute. You were a recipient of the
Nobel
Award.
That's how we met.
That's right.
That's how we met. Yep. That's how I got him on the show.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
So I'm curious, what drew you towards Acton Institute?
Well, actually, it kind of happened, as I said, I went to college in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and it was there that I had my conversion to Catholicism. And when I had decided that really the Lord was calling me to make this step, to recognize the truth of the Catholic Church, I didn't really know many Catholics. And so I talked to a professor who said, well, you should go and meet Father Robert Sirico. He is
a great hero of mine. Yeah.
At the Catholic Information Center. He's the president of the Acton Institute. I knew a little bit about Acton at the time. And so a friend and I met with Father Sirico for about, 10 weekends before being received into the church. And a little bit later, I started to take part in some of the activities of the Acton Institute on a formal level. It was, Father Sirico is really a good priest, and he doesn't sort of constantly suck you into all of his activities. When I was coming into the church, he was focused on the theology and the spirituality, but as it became clear that I really resonated with the mission of the Acton Institute, I started writing book reviews and articles, and then I started to attend some of the activities of the Acton Institute Free and Virtuous Society Weekend, and then I've been speaking at Acton University for the last several years, talking about a number of topics, including John Henry and his political and social and economic thought, as well as aesthetics in the civil life. I even gave a talk on distributism and sort of third way economic thinking. So I think I met you, Tim, on a weekend seminar on C.S. Lewis and freedom. So I've really enjoyed their look at economics, politics, philosophy, and theology that attempt to get a society which is truly free, but is maintained by virtue and a sense of the natural law, so that basically it can be a flourishing society where freedom isn't just sort of freedom to do anything you want, but freedom to do what you ought, freedom to build the common good.
In our culture, in our society, we live in a country that was founded on this idea of separation of church and state, and we've kind of taken that a little bit further to where we almost now have a separation of church and civil society to a certain extent.
Oh, gotcha.
And so this interplay of theology and economics, to me, it's fascinating and much needed to bring that connection between theological topics and kind of have that theological lens as we're looking at some of these economic issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, some people will go, even farther than that they'll say, well, everything is theological. And so, they'll want to have a kind of theological politics or a theological economics. And I think that perhaps, goes in the other direction. I think these are two sort of common errors. They go on, two different ditches. I think the Catholic position, and I think a lot of Orthodox Protestants and Eastern Orthodox, groups have also had the same view, is that there's a certain autonomy to economic thought, like any science, but also theology is what brings the vision at the end, so that then you can use the techniques and what you learn from the science of economics to actually get a society that, that takes account of sound economics, but also has truly good intentions. It's one of the Acton Institute's mottos is, sound economics and good intentions together. And I think that's an important thing, to keep both sides of that equation going. Theology for the vision, economics for the technical details and the how-to.
So in your article that we want to discuss a little bit here, the seven deadly sins of socialism,
which you, I love the title of, by the
right,
way,
exactly. You really look at the anthropological side of that. So the understanding, yeah, the understanding of who a person is that we know from tradition, from philosophical scholarship, we have a good idea of the human makeup and the human psyche and who a human being is. And so your article really deals with the effects of socialism on, I guess, our understanding of the person.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, well, like I said, theology gives you this view, this long view, the end. I could say that it also gives you the beginning because it tells us who we are. We're free, rational creatures who exist in communion, and we have a transcendent destiny. Socialism breaks that down and basically says you're only a material being who has these material needs. You're a set of glands. You know, some of the new atheists like to call us moist robots. Well,
oh, that's, you know, nasty.
That's kind of the socialist.
Right, right.
We're kind of moist robots. We're determined, you know, by economic status and our physical being, and we don't have true freedom. So for them to say, well, we're going to clamp down on your economic freedom or any other freedom, you know, well, that's not a problem. But if the vision of the person is something else, with a transcendent destiny and a freedom and a call to be something bigger, you know, socialism is a real problem in that view.
How would you, Dr. Deevil, how would you define socialism for our listeners? How would you put a wrapper around that?
Well, you know, I addressed this in the Seven Deadly Sins article, you know, because a lot of people talk today about they want socialism. Basically, what they want is sort of, well, we want a happy ending or something like that, or we want a better welfare state. But really, historically, socialism has been defined by the fact that the government is going to own or completely direct all of the means of production. It's going to be a situation in which nobody has anything for their own. Nobody has any duties towards towards any particular part of this earth, but the state directs it all, and you are only a cog who might have to do something, but only because the state does so, it says so. And that's the major basis of the socialist view, is that the state directs economic activities, and the state is all in all. I mean, I think that's what puts together a lot of the movements of the 20th century and the 21st century. Whether they're called left or right, many of them have that sort of sense in which that the state is everything. You remember that the Nazi is short for national socialist, right?
Right.
There were international socialists and national socialists, but they all thought that everything belonged within the state. And the family is not the center of society as it is for the Catholic vision, but is instead simply something that can be moved around. And I think we see that today as well for many people. One of our presidential candidates, you know, wrote a book called "It Takes a Village" to raise a family, and you know, it's that view that the village kind of owns the family that's so troubling.
Well, that sounds almost like it harkens back to Plato's Republic too, right? Where it's really the duty of the state to sort of sort out children so that
right,
we can vector
right.
them
no,
into
are,
the
these are long term problems,
right?
the economist and philosopher Friedrich Hayek said that, you know, there's a sort of tendency in human beings, you know, we might call it as Catholics original sin, but there's this tendency to shy away from freedom and so want somebody else to take care of us, a nanny state or a pappy state or what, you know, whatever we want to call
the pajama
it.
Boy guy, have you ever seen him? You know, that sort of emblematic guy, the adult guy wearing his flannel pajamas all day, you know, because he's being nursed by the state. Is that the? I was going to ask you. You got ahead of me, which I appreciate. Which is what do you think is sort of the appeal or one of the appeals to socialism? What makes it? I mean, it just seems there's a certain kind of popularity to it now.
Yeah. Well, I do think that there is. I mean, that sort of pajama boy phenomenon. I mean, maybe, you know, there are all sorts of people who talk about parents these days coddling the helicopter parents. I mean, perhaps some of this has created it. That young people have, you know, they've been so constricted that they know nothing else, And any sort of freedom of economic initiative or incentive is sort of frightening to them. I mean, you know, maybe that's part of it. Part of it also is seeing the results of our system. I mean, here in the U.S., we like to call what we have a sort of free market, but for it's always been a mixed economy, and the mix has been getting, it seems to me, a little bit heavy on the state side, the state-directed side. So when people think about free markets or what they might call capitalism, they're thinking about this system that I might call crony capitalism, where people who are connected to the state are capable of getting, you know, getting a corner on markets and basically shutting out little guys. And so they think, oh, wow, this is a problem. It must be all the problem of these rich guys. Whereas the reality is the rich guys couldn't corner the markets so well if they didn't have the state to use as a hammer to keep people away. So I think that's part of it is, you know, there are social aspects, but there's also the reality that people see big corporations using the government, and they blame the big corporations, but they don't blame the government for abetting the big corporations.
Right, which, you know, it's kind of a, I think Catholic thought has looked at this problem of kind of the choice of two slaveries. You either have, you know, the slavery towards the state, the slavery towards the government, or you have certain thinkers that almost kind of saw a slavery towards capitalism, and they sort of saw the slave state. And so you had this sort of tradition of a third way come out of Catholic thought.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work on G.K. Chesterton and some of these thinkers like that, and I mean they do have a point that, you know, there are basically two enemies in a way: big business and big government. Now the problem is that my analysis of it is a little different from Chesterton's. I think that big business wouldn't have the power that it has were it not for the fact that big government gives it that power by seizing this sort of authority to direct the economy. Once you have a government that's directing the economy and commanding it, well, you know, rich and large corporations are going to want to get in on this. So, you know, the idea is, you know, when people say, oh, we should not allow these rich capitalists to have these high places, you know, I want to say, along with, you know, some other thinkers, well, then let's take down the high places. Let's truly level the field. So that's my analysis of that sort of duality you're talking about.
Well, and we are speaking with today here in the Catholic Cave, Dr. David Deevil from the University of St. Thomas in beautiful Minnesota. He's a professor of theology there, and you teach in the Catholic Studies Department, and you're also the editor of Logos Magazine. We've been talking a little bit about socialism. Let's peel back those layers a little bit. I noticed, so I'm referencing here your article that was published in the Stream back on June 2nd. You lay out these seven deadly sins of socialism, which, I love the title of that article. The first one is that socialism truncates the human person. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that, Charles Murray, who's basically a political thinker, an economic thinker, sociologist, he talks about this sort of Europe syndrome, whereby, you know, Europe today is basically limited to people thinking only about the material, only about their economic realities. You know, all they care about is getting, you know, a large number of weeks of vacation, social benefits, retiring at 50, and you know, living a kind of beach existence. They don't think about something transcendent. They don't think about the fact that we're not fed by bread alone. We aren't satisfied by simply having enough food on the table or having enough luxury goods. Socialism has a tendency to think only about us as material beings. Its origins are largely in sort of atheistic views, whereby we really are simply body and we're not spirit. And when you talk to socialists, they can't think beyond these questions of raw economics or how much stuff people have. Whereas a real view of the human person sees that you know, the richest people around are unhappy.
Right.
You know, they don't,
right,
they don't necessarily take on happiness because they have enough goods. We have in the U.S. One of the newest Nobel Prize winners in economics this last year, you know, did a study showing that Americans, no matter how much we've improved in our material goods, our lifespan is getting shorter because people are, you know, indulging in drug use and alcohol abuse, and there's more depression, more suicide. Well, if we were simply material beings, as socialists propose, in America, where there's really enough stuff for everybody and more, we would all be happy as clams. But we aren't, because we're spiritual beings.
What role do you think sort of a utilitarian view plays within the socialist framework?
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing, is that with a socialist view of the human person as simply being a body that has these sort of material needs, and there is no sort of spiritual level above, there's no sense in which anything is off the table. There are no,
right.
there are no intrinsically immoral
right,
things.
Right,
that's
right.
Why socialists talk about the fact that sometimes to build this perfect society, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. Whereas, you know, the Catholic viewpoint is that of St. Paul, who says that we should never do evil that good may abound. For a socialist, there is no such thing as a purely evil thing. It's all about creating this society that in the future we'll have, you know, everybody will be okay. But now we have to crack a few eggs.
Right. This is how the gulag systems get built.
Right, right.
Because you have to move to the enemy of the state. Hey, another one of the seven deadly sins of socialism that you point out is that, and I think this one's particularly important, socialism denies the right of the family. It seems like the family has increasingly come under attack. What role do you see the family having in the current society? Are there strong socialist impulses that are sort of attacking the family now?
Yeah, I think there are. I think there's, I recently saw a new book by a woman, I think her name is Abby Wachter, called No Child Left Alone, all about this tendency of, you know, governments, states, to be mandating everything for children and saying how parents can raise them, what they can have in their lunches, what they can't have in their lunch, when they can be left alone. And there's this, I think there's a, it's sort of an ominous creeping aspect to this government role over children that I think is indicative of a sort of socialist mindset, that the children are, you know, they belong to the state ultimately.
Whereas, right, don't you dare send your...
The reality is that doesn't work.
Right, like if you dare as a parent, you know, send your son or daughter to the, you know, to elementary school and with a bag of Fritos in their lunch sack, you know, you're liable to get called into the principal's office.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's that claim over the very ordinary life of human beings that's a little bit frightening. Certainly the Catholic Church has always acknowledged that... That occasionally the state needs to step in where there's abuse or serious neglect, but carrying, you know, giving your kid a bag of Fritos or M&Ms in the lunch doesn't strike me as rising to that level.
Yeah, I definitely think the materialistic aspect to a certain extent of socialism, you see that rampantly in the school systems, in education. You know, the goals of education have shifted from good citizenship or virtue.
Forming a kind of person.
Character-forming right. Education to making somebody college and career ready. In other words, mm-hmm. Making them so that they can produce for the state.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's that view of producers, consumers and producers, that's so worrisome because, again, as you say, in older views of education, it was forming a human person to be a responsible citizen. In the American context as well as most of the world, that meant a responsible citizen under God, where there were moral boundaries. Now it's sort of a view that children are simply out there to sort of improve the GDP. I'm in favor of free markets. I hope the GDP may live long and prosper, but it's not the only thing, and it doesn't fulfill us at all. So that kind of thinking is really destructive of itself.
You know, and I've read some other thinkers too, and this Catholic thinkers on this topic. Do you would you agree with this? As I understand, like a James Kalb, who's I think is pointing us towards one of the reasons that we're headed in this direction is that material goods to a certain extent are lower hanging fruit than say the transcendental. So really become so it's easier to pursue a larger flat screen TV as a person and acquire the means to have one than it is to really work on, say, becoming virtuous.
I think that's right. And in our country and in the West more broadly, there's this great dispute about what it means to be virtuous. So I think politicians think to themselves, you know, I'll try to go for my version of virtue, but, you know, it's easier to hit that low-hanging fruit and, you know, as Bill Clinton used to say, it's the economy, stupid. Well, I think it's the economy as well, but an economy exists within a culture. And if you don't have that sort of cultural sphere, and if you don't have the sort of legal and judicial sphere operating in a healthy way, you can have all the flat-screen TVs in the world, but you can still have a lot of depression and a lot of sense that the country and the world is going in the wrong direction. Because you need all of those. You need the free market, you need a healthy cultural sphere, and cult, religion, is at the heart of culture. When religion is being oppressed and being ignored, that's not going to flourish. And finally, you need a healthy and thriving legal sphere where rights are honored, where contracts are honored. I think a lot of people are very skeptical that right now the American legal system is really operating on, you know, on sort of full throttle. The same with our cultural system.
And that kind of covers, I think, that third deadly sin that you talked about in your article, that socialism crushes civil society. I mean, those are the legal system, the culture, you know, all of that is what makes up civil society. So that very much, I think, is kind of what you were getting at when you were talking about socialism crushing civil society. You also bring up that socialism promotes class warfare.
Yeah, that one's got my attention too.
Right. Yeah. I think that's one people traditionally associate with socialism or communism, is this pitting of the classes together against each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote a follow-up to that Seven Deadly Sins article called Three Mistakes Catholics Make Who Flirt with Socialism. And, you know, I think a lot of the inequality talk falls into this class warfare talk. Now, I'm not saying that there are no questions about our sense of inequality these days, but a lot of people talk about, you know, a sort of sense of absolute inequality as if it's an evil. But what they neglect to see is that, you know, in many ways, we have all these flat-screen TVs. Poor people today live much better than many middle-class people did, you know, 40 years ago. But, of course, that's not the solution to our society's problems. So, you know, to stoke up this animus against the rich, and oftentimes it has a sort of anti-Semitic, you know, turn to it, you know, rich Jewish bankers or something like that. I think it's a tremendous mistake that people make, is to pit people against one another. What we need are entrepreneurs, investors, workers, and government all working together to create an environment in which economic initiative can flourish, in which people can enter markets as workers or investors, and they can truly thrive, not, you know, pit one group of people against another. I think that way leads to chaos.
Well, and I think that realm of economics, you already brought up one of my heroes, Hayek. Hayek, Mark, is from the Austrian school. I always tease Mark here on the show a little bit, Dr. Teevil, because he's always trying to smuggle in on us either Hegel or Heidegger or Kant, and they haven't come up yet. And so I just want to point out that Hayek has.
Yeah, yeah. I'm staying quiet about Hegel for this particular show.
But I wanted to point out, though, one of the great – I'm so glad you brought that up, because it almost seems like it suggests almost like – That Rawlsian view of driving towards these absolutely equal outcomes, and if there aren't equal outcomes, then we must infer that there's an inference there that something's broken about the machine, which is quite the opposite, I think, of the I would say a more say Catholic view, which is that, you know, people are endowed with talents and endowed with gifts, and it's through our cooperation with the Holy Spirit, out of love of God and neighbor, that creates human flourishing. And it's sort of by definition, because we have free will, we suffer from, you know, the effects of original sin. Not everyone's going to, not everyone's going to put in the same amount of effort. Not everyone's born into the same kind of opportunities, think of, especially globally. So it seems almost like a fool's errand, part this aspect of socialism, to when we drive towards, identical outcomes, seems like an impossibility to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, one thing that people, on the sort of the left and the right are correct about is that it really is all about, early child things. Now, people on the left will say, well, what we need to do is have more programs. Again, we need the state to provide some sort of a program, Head Start or something equivalent. But the problem is that it attacks the right problem, that children are, have different, different beginnings. But the problem is that we have this huge breakdown of the family. I mean, you get, at this point in history in the U.S., something like, a third of children are not living with both parents. Another economic thinker, George Gilder, once said that, you could never build a welfare state big enough and effective enough to make up for the two-parent family of a mother and father. And I think that's the problem. In order to get people to be able to use those gifts, to develop those talents that you're talking about, Tim, what we need to do is somehow allow for families to thrive and flourish. But if we're going to crush their authority because they've sent Fritos in the lunch, we don't have much of a chance of that. So I think it's the family that's at the root of many of these economic problems.
Well, Dr. Deevil, we're running out of time here. This has been a fantastic conversation, and
scratched the surface.
This conversation could go in so many different directions. We'll have to have you back at some point here.
But that sounds great.
But why don't you share for a few minutes with your listeners some of the projects, some of the things that you're working on right now?
Yeah, well, right now, as Tim mentioned, I'm the editor of Logos, which is a Catholic quarterly. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year of this journal. It's a fantastic thing. Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture. You can find us at stthomas.edu/logos, L-O-G-O-S. We're read in over 100 countries, and we've had a lot of the greatest Catholic intellectuals, writing for us. So we're really proud of our accomplishment of 20 years. We're trying to put together a book of greatest hits right now for that. And we have a new issue that will be coming out soon. We have number of topics in each issue. So we have the journal going on, and I myself am working on several projects. One on Bram Stoker's Dracula, since we're getting close to Halloween. Dracula is showing us basically a culture of death and a culture of life. So when you're thinking about Halloween, think not just about the bad, but think about, all the good characters in Dracula who are fighting him.
Van Helsing.
Interestingly enough, in Stoker's novel, it's evangelicals and Catholics working together, which I think is a nice touch. So that's one of the biggest things that I'm working on, as well as an essay on Father James Shaw, the great Catholic political philosopher.
Oh, one of my heroes, yes.
Yeah, he has a new book out on education. It's called Docilitas, on being taught. So I'm really enjoying looking back at a lot of his work, thinking about some of the topics we've been talking about, as well as these topics of education and of being formed as people who are more than just a series of glands and material wants.
Well, and I can wholeheartedly endorse Logos as well. And boy, that'd make a subscription, make a great Christmas present for everyone listening.
It really would.
Well, and I, part of the reason of the premise behind the Catholic Cave is to try to make these great, solid, Catholic intellectuals accessible and put these kind of resources in our audience's hands. So again, thank you so much, Dr. Deevil. It has been fantastic having you on the program. Again, like Mark said, we just barely scratched the surface, and so we're going to have you back really, really soon to get into not only these topics, but I know you're a scholar on Blessed John Henry Newman, and boy, there's a ton there as well. So again, thank you for coming on the show.
All right, thanks for having me, guys.
I've got the spirit.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection.
Hi, this is Barbara McWiggin, host of The Good Fight here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In Here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and you can join me for Cresta in the Afternoon here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The best of EWTN plus great local programming. That's what you get when you support Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Wow, that was fantastic, wasn't it, Mark?
Great guest, yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Deevil, University of St. Thomas up there in beautiful Minnesota. We touched on socialism, some other things. I think I want us, Mark, as we in this last segment here, kind of wrap things up a little bit. Let's go back to the family. Let's go back to, we were talking about how socialism, you know, one of its ill effects, one of its seven deadly sins, as Dr. Deevil would say, is that it really seems to attack and fracture the family. What are some of the implications of that?
You know, I think that almost becomes a political Rorschach test to a certain extent. You know, if you ask people, okay, what defines what? Does the family define the state? In other words, is the state pretty much comprised of families who get together,
whose building block
is constituent of the broader society.
From
there, you have a community of families that are there for mutual protection. They're there for mutual benefit,
the common good.
Exactly. Or is it the opposite? Do you have a society that defines the makeup and the character of what a family should be and what a family ought to be? I really think that's one of those dividing questions where if you ask that right, you can instantly tell whether this person's on kind of the left side of the fence or the right side of the fence.
Yes, I know in political philosophy, that's one of those fundamental questions that you got to ask right up front, which is you have the person and you have the state, and which one comes first? And if you answer the state with a capital S, the state comes first, the individual is subordinate, the person is subordinated to the state, then you begin to have systems of totalitarianism, you have systems of communism, you have systems of socialism, because what the state is, the project of the state is about this collectivism, right, that has to supersede the rights of individuals. I think it was Dr. Deevil who said, you know, we might have to crush a few eggs, you know, break a few eggs to make the omelet. Well, you can crush human beings as part of the project of bringing about the ends of the state when the state's the highest good, which is the complete opposite of Catholic social teaching.
Right. And I think, though, when you look at Catholic social teaching and how it differs from socialism, but even this sort of laissez-faire liberal, classical liberalism that involves capitalism, what you wind up with is the Catholic Church kind of says, well, the center of society is neither the state nor is it the individual, it's the family, it's community, it's that
community that's Trinitarian
in nature. Exactly. You have with the Trinity you have Father, Son, Holy Spirit. With the family you have mother, father, offspring, you know, making that nuclear family from which that's where society really springs. So it's not exactly individual rights, because what do you have in a family? You have self-sacrifice,
right?
You have virtue, you have you know, basically setting your own wants and wishes and desires aside for the sake of a higher good. When society is based off of that, I think you've got a much better starting ground than you do if you kind of look at it and say, well, it's the individual or a set of individual rights where I can stand there and say, it's my right, it's my right, it's
right.
My right. I think you wind up with a much better society when you look at it as it being based off of that family.
Well, and it moves us away from a lot of these systems like socialism have direct appeals to a kind of self-interest, and it moves us away from self-interest into something much greater and transcendental, which is love. right? The heart of the culture ought to be love. It's a civilization of love, as St. John Paul II called it.
And what do you need to have love? You need to have another. You need to have, you can't, I mean, people think you can, but you can't really
pretty
love.
Pretty sure Pajama Boy was by himself, right?
I was going to say, you can't really love yourself, but maybe we need right? to ask Pajama Boy that question if you can. But you really need that other.
Exactly.
And the reason why is because you need to be able to deny yourself to a certain extent to be able to love somebody else. That was the huge revelation of the cross, right? That ultimate exactly. love is ultimate self-denial, and they go hand in hand. And that's what you learn in the context of a family. I mean, you don't grow up and live in a family without learning that lesson very quickly.
Well, and the family's, I think, correctly called the domestic church. And socialism crushes that, right?
Right, right. Because you have to get that out of the way so that you can have ultimate allegiance to the state or to the people or to whatever other governing body you want to set up as head of this socialist state.
Seems to me, too, one of the observations one might make over the last, if you know, 50, 60 years, something like this, is you think of sort of, let's go back to the 50s, where we tend to think of like Leave It to Beaver, for those of you may be familiar with the television, where you have a mom and a dad, intact, you know, two children, intact family, you know, living this kind of somewhat idealistic, you know, kind of lifestyle. And that's been reimagined and fractured. What's been part of that project? Well, part of the project has been through a radical feminism to shatter the bond between husband and wife, so that the wife would no longer be simply a sort of a domestic who is dependent upon a husband. But now you have what? You have people who are what? Dependent on, now you have fractured families, you have divorce or cohabitation. Who are you to, if you're not attached to one another? Who you have to be attached to? Who you're dependent on? Your employer,
right?
Right. So we've reduced the family from a domestic church, constitutive of love for each other and love of God, and we've in large part replaced it to mere economic arrangements between ourselves and employers.
Right. And if you don't have an employer, who do you go to help?
The state.
The state, rather than a system where you have a community of families called the church, where, you know, when one
for
person,
mutual support
for mutual support, and when one member's in need, you go to the larger body of the church. And there's a give and take there. I mean, I think as that system has been replaced by state welfare and things like that, the church has
programs.
Yeah,
don't forget programs, Mark.
the church has simultaneously moved towards wanting to be more involved with state sanctioned welfare, and at the same time,
which has been disastrous, has I been, might say,
right. And at the same time, they've been kind of pushed out of the game a little bit, so that they're less and less available, I think, to the families in need that are part of their community.
Well, there's these tentacles of secularization or streams of secularization that I think have been pouring in, you know, pouring into the church through some of these financial arrangements that we've made, that Holy Mother Church made with, say, the government on different efforts. And so it's just this close entanglement, I think, has resulted in a lot of problems that we've had.
Yeah, I think though the church is starting to come out of that a little bit. I think a lot of the charitable organizations within the church are really beginning to kind of try to get past this idea of, well, we are serving the greater society that's out there, and they're starting to try to incorporate the poor, the needy more into the church. They're trying to kind of get past this sort of us versus them mentality that inculcates, and they're really trying to create more of a community of love and a community of charity, a community of stewardship.
Right. Well, you know what, Mark? We're just about out of time, so we're going to have to wrap things up here on the Catholic Cave. Again, thanks to Dr. David Deevil from the University of St. Thomas up there in Minnesota for coming on the program today. Boy, we got to have him back real soon. I've got to talk to him more about Newman. I'm fascinated with the work of John Henry, Blessed John Henry Newman. Hopefully he'll get canonized real soon. Plus, there's so many things we just scratched the surface on.
And that's all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for the day. Just a reminder, Catholic Cave is available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Until next time, may God bless. Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.